Tuesday forecast, sunny and hot, 30% chance of rain, a high of 89 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Right now, 77 Kenosha, 75 Racine, 73 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I wonder if you or somebody you know has had their life touched by epilepsy. I know I have. I have a younger brother. My youngest sibling has contended with the effects of epilepsy for quite a few years, actually, for more than a quarter century. And so that's one of the reasons why I found my interest drawn to a brand new book, which is called A Petit Mal, a Mother's Healing Love Song, in which we hear from a very, very gifted writer, Ana Maria Caballero, about the experience of seeing her young son dealing with epilepsy. And also trying to navigate through the often bewildering corridors of medical science in terms of trying to come to grips with what was going on, what exactly was happening, and what could be done to help her young son. The result is a really marvelous memoir. Ana Maria Caballero is a first-generation Colombian-American poet and artist, and that gift of poetry, her award-winning talent for poetry, certainly shines through in the way that this has been put together. And it is a book not only captivating in terms of the words on the page, but also the images on the page as well. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Ana Maria Caballero about her book, again called A Petit Mal, A Mother's Healing Love Song, from Black Spring Press. Ana Maria Caballero, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for having me. I'm very grateful to be here and to be able to speak a little bit about my book.
Before we talk specifically about your son and his story, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your own love of the written word, and tell us where that comes from. Does it come from anything in particular, or from someone who was an inspiration to you?
I come from a family of writers and artists on my father's side. My grandfather was a historian, a short story writer, a revered columnist in Colombia, where I'm originally from, and a professor. He was just sort of this incredible, knowledgeable, erudite man. And I also have several artists in my family, in my bloodline. So I think that there's definitely a sort of a direct, connection to the written word and to art. And I've always felt that I was an artist, but my medium is language, is words, is paper, is pencil, is a word processor and a printer. And I love imagining how words look like on a page, and I love rhythm and internal rhyme and how things might sound to a reader within themselves. So I think it's something that's been within me ever since I can remember, really. I mean, I think my earliest memories of being a writer are probably, you know, when I was 12 years old, I started writing my first poems.
Well, you're certainly a wonderful writer, yeah. And I have so thoroughly enjoyed this marvelous book. Tell our listeners about the first instance in which there appeared to be something physically amiss with your young son. Tell our listeners about him, how old he was at this point in time, and what the first signs of trouble were.
He was in kindergarten. He was 6 years old, and he started leaning back and laughing in a way that was strange, but it wasn't strange enough to still. It happened, let's say, on a Friday. I saw him do it as we were walking out of his school. He did it against a wall. He just, like, walked backwards against the wall and did it. And then I saw it again at the house that night, and I took him to the pediatrician, actually, right away. I mean, I wasn't ready to run to the hospital, but I'm like, this is very strange. So I went to after hours, and I asked the doctor, and she said to give him Dramamine and that maybe he was having, a bit of nausea. Like, she didn't know what it was either. And then the next day I saw him do it three more times. And that's when I ran to the emergency room and I knew there was something off. His seizures were very short. They were laughing seizures. He laughed, which was really, really creepy to see him sort of laughing in a way that wasn't himself. Like, even though it was, you know, something that's supposedly joyful, it was external in some way. And fortunately they didn't, you know, knock him to the ground or make him sort of dizzy afterwards. He would emerge from the seizure and, like, just pop right into life. Like, he would even have them playing soccer, lean against a tree and then keep playing. But it was enough, you know, I mean, that's obviously not something you want to see happen ever.
Right. It was, I think at some points it was described as a moment of seeming imbalance when your young son would have the sensation that he was about to fall, although he wouldn't fall. I mean, he wouldn't actually fall, but he would feel as though he were about to fall. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. So he felt the need to lean against something or to grab something. So he'd always reach for something. He had, like, the wherewithal to do that, which was a good sign. I mean, it was, you know, quote unquote good sign, because it wasn't like if he was on a playground, right? That's when all these questions start coming up. Like, what if he's on a bicycle? What if he's in a swimming pool? What if he's in the tub? What if he's on the playground? So he'd have the wherewithal to reach for something to steady himself until they passed, because they only lasted a few seconds. But it did obviously terrify us and then, you know, limited his activities in a huge way, because, you know, we live in Florida where there's a lot of water and a lot of activities that involve water. And it's really scary to think about what could happen if he's in a place where he's not able to steady himself.
Mm. You do mention in the book that your own father, some years earlier, and if I remember correctly, it was maybe even a year or so before your young son was born, your father suffered some kind of brain injury and essentially never woke up. Can you tell us about that and about the connection between that sad incident or situation and then what was befalling your young son?
Yes, so my father had a stroke. And he was just unable to speak, really, or unable to communicate and move much. And that happened, you know, at the time of writing of the book, it had happened 6 years ago. So it was something that I had, you know, learned to experience and learned to deal with. But truly, you know, for me, the moment of feeling that I was caring for a sick father and a sick son, I think resulted in a lot of the writing in the book.
Mm.
I needed a catharsis, you know, to be able to process what that was like, to see sort of illness in many ways manifest within my life.
And so I'm assuming that, for instance, some of the poems that we find within the text of your book are poems that were written in the moment as you were experiencing this.
Yes, yes. So the book is really almost like a scrapbook of the experience of the seizures starting and us trying to understand them and trying to piece together what could look like healing and what could look like treatment for him. Because, you know, at some point we didn't even think healing was possible, that it would have to be sort of a form of attenuation, which means, you know, you're treating the disease in a way that it stops being eruptive of your life, so that you're able to live with it, right? It's like a condition. And there's a poem that I write in the book, about conditions, like what on one condition you can live on the condition of this, terms and conditions. It's a really powerful and loaded word. But definitely the writing is very fragmented and very eruptive. And I think that reflects sort of the seismic experience that we were living with eruptions of sort of the unexpected.
Right. We're speaking with Ana Maria Caballero about her memoir called A Petty Mall, A Mother's Healing Love Song, which tells the story of what she and her husband experienced when their young son began to experience strange, unexplainable seizures, which ultimately were diagnosed as some form of epilepsy. I want to be sure to ask you a couple of questions about the way in which this book is written. I love the way it is written, but there are ways in which it is kind of unexpected in the way it is put together. That, for instance, many times we are reading books we are reading words that do not form complete sentences. And there is in a sense, a very fragmentary look to the book and feel to the words. And I think it is quite effective, but I wonder how much of that was a very conscious, artistic choice on your part. And if so, what was behind that choice?
Yeah, so the book issues many articles and pronouns and punctuation marks because I think I was trying to approach the experience, approach meaning by carving out sort of the excess, right? So I wanted to just like have the words be less adorned. There's a quote that I really love by poet Mary Howe that says that for poets, it's really hard to resist metaphor. Because then we have to live with and endure the thing itself, and that hurts us for some reason. And I think it's really accurate and very powerful. I mean, when we adorn language, when we decorate it, sometimes it's because we're afraid of feeling what it is we're saying. But the book really just cuts away and, like, carves out the fat. And it just leaves, you know, very essential words in a way that might sound or read unexpected, but I think are able to generate an emotional reaction within the reader.
Mm. You've made the choice for this book to be written in the present tense. What is behind that choice?
Well, I wrote it as I was living it. That's because I was in the present tense. Of course, I edited it afterwards for many, many months, but the core of it was written in the present moment. As you know, as soon as we left the doctor's appointment, I was scribbling notes. So it was of the moment. It's a very visceral sort of lived record of that moment of my life.
And it's particularly striking. You already mentioned the fact that certain pronouns will be missing, or certain articles to give the book a very spare look. And it's especially interesting when you will pose a question But that question will not end with a question mark. I'm not sure, but I don't think there are any question marks anywhere in this manuscript. And that's a very intriguing choice as well. What is behind that?
Yes, thank you for asking that. You know, it's a very thoughtful question. So I decided to omit the question mark because the entire book is a question. It is a question mark in and of itself. And I wanted to draw attention to the act of questioning by omitting that mark. So, you know, as you sense there's something missing and you wonder about it, but it brings you in wondering and in thinking, you know, why this happened. It makes you come closer to look at the questions themselves. I mean, if the mark was there as you had expected, you might not look twice at the sentence. But now you're looking at it again, perhaps because you're like, is this a question? Is it not? And then you realize, you know, of course it's a question. And that makes you come closer.
Hmm. One of the most difficult aspects of all of this is that, I mean, it's hard enough when we have someone we love who is diagnosed with something very serious, and that diagnosis is very clear and specific. We know what's going on, why it's happening, and what's probably going to happen next. This, of course, was a situation in which so much of this was couched in unknowns. And at one point, you tell us in the book that the underlying cause of 50% of seizures is unknown. How difficult was that aspect of all of this? The fact that, especially in the early going, there were so few answers to the many questions that you and your husband had about your son and what had befallen him.
It was really challenging. You know, I definitely think that we embarked on a quest to find an answer. We just like wouldn't take no answer for an answer. And we insisted on the fact that, you know, we wanted to know more. We wanted to do all sorts of testing. We wanted to look for alternative methods of healing, because I felt like perhaps the answer wouldn't be fully formed, but we could get something better than what we were being given. And I had that faith, that like sense inside me that it was possible. And that's why we insisted.
One of the clarifications that you give us at one point is the difference between seizures, tonic-clonic seizures, once known as grand mal, and then focal seizures or petit mal seizures. And it was your son's seizures were more of the latter, and that's also what my own younger brother experiences when he has a seizure. I'd never stopped to think about the literal meaning of the old terminology. A grand mal seizure is really bad, and a petit mal seizure is just a little bad. I mean, that's literally what those words mean, but that's, you know, talk about a misnomer. I mean, there is something so terrifying about these seizures, no matter how they manifest themselves. And even these seizures that your son was experiencing were so frightening. Explain why they are called focal seizures.
It's because they emerge in one location in the brain. So they're able to pinpoint where the seizure is being generated. It's almost like an earthquake, right? They're able to say, okay, this is ground zero for the earthquake or for the seizure. So that's why they're focal. But there's some that are sort of more generalized, you know, sort of more vast within the brain. And that's why that differentiation is made. And I definitely, you know, did think that the term of petit mal was really an interesting term for anything. And obviously, you know, the book braids the story of the illness, a much more serious illness of a good friend's baby. So, you know, I did feel like as I was going through this, like my bad was littler than the bad that she was experiencing. And it made me just think about sort of that, you know, the levels of bad and how sometimes we don't need things to be, you know, so devastating for us to learn lessons and evolve. And so that's why I gave my book that name, Le Petit Mal.
Mm. You early on in the book begin referring to the doctors in the hospital and in clinic and so on as witch doctors. Can you explain what drew you to that term?
Yeah, so I love alternative medicine. I think that there's so much wisdom there and other ways of knowing and learning and feeling and experiencing the world. And people, you know, who don't understand it think it's witchy. It's not of this world in a way that perhaps feels heretical to traditional medicine. But for me, that term is full of tenderness, and it's a reclaiming of it and a loving of it. So I say it with pride when I say my witch doctors.
So you're using that term more to refer to those that attempted to help your son through alternative means.
Yes, exactly. Versus the Western doctors.
Right. When you think of what the sort of the standard care was that they were trying to extend to him, what left you most dissatisfied about that?
I think that there was a treatment of the parents that was like we didn't deserve to know. I felt like the doctors were holding back information because it was complicated and probably not clear cut, and explaining it would be difficult and probably lead to more questions. But I really didn't think that kind of paternalistic treatment was fair, especially when, you know, so much is at stake.
One really interesting moment in the book is when you are in search of a second opinion of your son's situation. And you write, to get a second opinion, you must first get medical records of first opinion. This is wicked. Explain why, of all things, you call that situation wicked.
Oh, my goodness. The whole medical records system in the U.S. is just a nightmare. I mean, you have to use faxes to communicate and request information, and you know, I play around with the word fax and its similarity to another expression in my book, because it's unbelievable that, you know, I'm the guardian of my son and I'd have to write letters and fax them over requesting information that I wasn't given after going to the appointment. I understand if they can't email it or they can't, you know, readily sort of share it because of concerns, but you know, I requested information at the doctor, and they just wouldn't print it out for me. They wouldn't hand me the sheet. I had to go through these processes, and then I had to write what was going on with my son in my own words. They said that was literally a request. Please explain your child's situation in your own words.
You, as you have already touched on, eventually go exploring alternative forms of medicine in search of help, and it sounds like in Colombia, as in other places as well, there is perhaps an especially robust landscape of alternative medicine. Can you just describe that to us?
So you know, I have a passage in my book where I run into graduated at a high school reunion, and he'd become an endocrinologist. And I was talking to him about my experience at the hospital with my son, because he happened to work there, as well as in Colombia. And he mentioned something to me that I think was really poignant, which was that at the hospital, and it happens in many U.S. hospitals, he said, there's such expensive equipment, and doctors have a real pressure to use it. There's real pressure, he said, to use this equipment and to frame it in such a way that it looks like results. And that sometimes better results are received if you just stop and think. and stop and observe and stop and look without all the fancy tools. So I think, you know, that really sort of struck me, and that really, I think, summarizes my experience. In Colombia, I felt like the doctors were really asking questions. I didn't feel like they were asking questions in the U.S., but also it was the alternative doctors who asked questions.
Well, we follow this journey with great interest through the course of your fascinating and moving book, and we'll leave it to our listeners to explore the details. At one point, you pose this intriguing question towards the very end of the book, actually. Am I writing a story that is not mine to write? That's an intriguing question you were asking yourself, and what answer did you ultimately come up with?
Yes, it's my story in the sense that it was my experience living it, and it also had to do with me at one point thinking, you know, when do I decide to medicate my son? At what point do we do a treatment that supposedly will work immediately versus, you know, holding off to try to find potentially healthier, more holistic solutions? So I think that there was, you know, as a writer, when you're writing about other people, you always feel like you're sort of taking stories from them in a way. But at the end of the day, you know, it's all passing through you, and it's how you're interpreting it and you're filtering and sieving it and putting it back out into the world in a way that does belong to you. One of my favorite writers said that, Czesław Miłosz says that once a writer is born into the family is finished. and I think there's great accuracy in that. And I'm happy I wrote the story. I'm happy it's a record.
And can I ask to conclude how your son is at this moment?
He's great. Thank you for asking. He's great. I won't ruin the ending, but he's great. Thank God and thank the universe. Mm.
The book again is A Petty Mall, A Mother's Healing Love Song. And the author, Ana Maria Caballero. Ana Maria Caballero, it was great to speak with you, great to read your book and to follow this intriguing and thought-provoking story, which is so beautifully written. Thank you so much. Thank you for being my morning show guest, and best wishes to you and your whole family.
Thank you all so much. Very grateful. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
And for part two of today's morning show, the Thursday morning show here on WGTD, I'm really happy to be sitting opposite a fine musician from Racine by the name of George Baumgard, who directs a group that perhaps you have heard something about called the Spirit of Racine Music Makers. This was a group that formed in the summer of 2020. And what an interesting time that was to try to get a new musical endeavor off the ground. The summer of 2020, of course, was when we were in the heart of the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And George Baumgard wanted to kind of fill the void with music making. and did so. And this group is going strong, 50 strong, as a matter of fact. And they have their spring concert coming up this Sunday afternoon, June 4th, 2 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, a concert titled Music for the World. And we're going to be talking with George Baumgart a little bit about the formation of this group and what was behind it and the sort of their mission and some of the things that they have done and some of the things that they are hoping to do in the future. George Baumgart, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about Spirit of Racine Music Makers, I think it would be good for our listeners to get a little capsule biography of where you are from originally and a little bit about the experiences and people that have shaped you, particularly as a musician.
Well, thank you. I actually grew up in Racine. So started playing the piano at the age of five and continued on with my education at UW Parkside in music education. And as a result of that, I always had a job at church, either playing the organ or at in later years to be the director of music as well as liturgy at Sacred Heart Parish in Racine. All told, it's been 55 years of church music and on a part-time basis. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. After I had concluded my 40th year at Sacred Heart, and as we were starting to go into the pandemic, it made it very difficult to bring back choirs and so on. So the amount of effort to be able to put into it wasn't quite the same. So I decided this was probably a good time for me to look for other avenues of music, adventure. And so an afternoon in July of 2020, Laura Sumner Kuhn and my wife and I were sitting down on our deck, and they kept saying, well, why don't we form a group? Why don't we get something that we get everybody to come back and either virtually or however we can do it? And so sure enough, I invited initially all of my former choir members, Bell Choir members, to form the Spirit of Racine Music Makers. And we are 501c3, so we do accept donations, and that certainly it helps us move on from that. Over the time when we were doing it virtually, that was quite an experience because we actually had our musicians take the music that was recorded by our accompanist and were their parts, and they would record their individual parts, send it in to me, and then I mixed those together for our concert that we were putting together. I hope that never has to happen again. That was a lot of work, and not just on my part, but on their part as well. But no, things are going really good. I think one thing that I would like to stress is our mission statement that we have, Greg, and it's that the Spirit of Racine Music Makers endeavors to bring peace, social justice, and love to the world through the power and beauty of music. So, that's on everybody's feeling of what we're doing with each program that we do put on. And so I try to make sure that the music that I select for that encompasses that, basically our theme that we have.
I'm just so intrigued by the thought of starting up a music group in the summer of 2020 when so much of the performing arts had essentially ground to a halt. So it just kind of says something about your vision and your courage and maybe a little bit of foolhardiness mixed in there as well. But actually, it turns out that wasn't a foolish undertaking at all. It's because here you are several years later going strong, stronger than ever, actually. Just clarify, in the early going of Spirit of Racine, so that was a point in time when essentially it was unsafe to gather together, so I assume there was nothing in the way of rehearsing together in a room, and probably that didn't happen for some time.
That's quite true. We would have maybe people who would be singing a duet. we might be able to get them together so that I can accompany them through that. And in actuality, our bell choir practiced in our garage.
Ah.
And that was it kind of cold during November and December of 2020. But everybody wore a mask. They had the visors, you know, and they were spread out enough so that, you know, we could do that. But that the bells were the only ones that really met in person.
Right.
So everybody else basically was to send in their music to me to be compiled and then produced, you know, for a recording.
Right. And so, for instance, as people were sending things in, then you had to react to what they had and had to make sure that this is in tune and
yes,
this is rhythmically correct, and so it can be mixed into the whole. That really does sound like a lot of work.
It was. But it was enjoyable from the standpoint that I knew that this is something that the people really wanted to do. They wanted to get back to singing. And this was an opportunity for them to do that, maybe on a disconnected basis in some ways. But, you know, we always kept them in contact with by email and, you know, get things, let them know that, yep, we got to redo this one or we have to do this. So in order to get the finished product.
Right. So you put all of that together for what amounted to your first concert, which was virtual.
Correct.
Nothing that involved people coming. So help us understand kind of the evolution from there, you know, in terms of when did you first begin being able to rehearse together, and at what point did you start to actually perform for people in terms of an audience being present? Just sketch for us kind of the development of things.
Okay. Well, after that initial time for spring, we were able to secure the property, or I shouldn't say the property, but the Meredith Funeral Home has the building across the street, Preservation Hall. And the Merediths were so kind to let us practice on Wednesday nights. Now, everybody wore a mask. Everybody was 6 feet apart. And so it made it kind of difficult to listen and try to get everything together. But so then we had our first concert that spring. It was live, so people could watch and listen. We had, I think, over 600 people that tuned in to us. We had a very small, limited audience of like 50. And that was done by design so that we would not create any issues for anybody that would be coming in. Then we expanded a little bit more as COVID started to take its rest. And we had our fall, or I should say our Christmas concert, then was at Preservation Hall that first time. Very good. We had a really good turnout that one. Our spring concert was held at the De Koven Foundation. And then our Christmas concert was held at the Covenant that year, which is the old Our Savior's Lutheran Church on Washington and Taylor. This year, of course, we're going to be at First Presbyterian. And then our Christmas concert again is going to be at the Covenant.
Very good. You've chosen some lovely spaces in which to make your music. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with George Baumgard, a well-known church musician in Racine, and most recently the creator and director of a group called Spirit of Racine Music Makers. And they present periodic concerts and around themes that involve social justice and world peace. And their next concert, their spring concert, if you will, is coming up this Sunday afternoon, June 4th, 2 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, a concert which is called Music for the World. By the way, is this a group in which one auditions, or do you essentially accept anybody into your ranks who just wants to come and sing?
That's a very good question, because most of the groups that are in Racine right now does have a requirement of an audition to come in. And I understand that because of the difficulty of the music, perhaps, that they'd be doing. Not that our music isn't difficult, but if this is going to be a community organization, I truly believe that everybody should be able to come and sing. We've been very blessed by having people who have sung in church choirs before, that have had some music experience, that it has not been an issue. Basically, if they're in between voices, trying to determine whether they're, the age has caught up with them and they are now an alto instead of a soprano, that's something. So we have more of an alto section than we do a soprano section. But it's open to anybody. From that standpoint, we would certainly love to be able to get some younger folks involved in it too. And I guess the best way to put that invitation out there is to come and hear us, see what we're all about. And what you're getting is a mix of the music that we always try to perform. So
there you go. So tell us how you put together this upcoming concert again with the theme of Music for the World.
Well, one of the things that I did is I went out to our favorite internet, and I put the Music for the World and came up with different
ones. So just did a search.
Yes, Google. Did a search on that. And there were a number of pieces that came up. And then I went to various publishers and found out what they would have for your groups of adult singers rather than, you know, for the universities and that. And so I was able to acquire quite a few of them. Just let me give you a little taste of those.
Sure.
So we're doing a John Rutter piece, Look to the World. John Rutter... if he could be my older brother, he would be it. I really enjoy his music, and our people really enjoy his music. It's something that you can grow into, I think.
Yeah.
But then we're also doing, as a contrast to that, those of you who remember the Rascals, we are doing their song, People Got to Be Free.
Oh.
And our bell choir is doing A Whole New World. We're doing Over the Rainbow, I Dream a World, which happens to be a poem by Andre Thomas. And it depicts early 1900s in the United States when the persecution of a lot of African Americans was taking place, you know, for work. And so that has somewhat become our, you know, predominant piece with each concert. We're also doing What a Wonderful World. And to keep things in mind for our bell choir, we're doing Ave Verum. We're doing the Mozart Alleluia Exaltet. And the choir will sing The Prayer, which Bocelli is not we were not able to get him for this concert, but we have good people to make up that.
There you go.
And then one of the staples that we've had is one song, the Martin Hamlisch piece, Marvin Hamlisch, I should say. And it's just a beautiful number. All the instruments are together, and you know, with the choir.
Yeah.
And so it's a good sending out piece.
Sounds like it. Yeah, and you mentioned before we went on the air that your group, which numbers right around 50 or more, is not just singers and not just bell ringers, but you have also other instrumentalists who are stirred into the mix.
Yes, we do. And I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of their willingness to volunteer to you know, play for us. Their commitment is not as great as our choral and handbell people. I send them out the music so they can work it through. I also send them a recording of the pieces that we're going to be doing so they can get a gist as far as a tempo that we will have for it. And then we just had our dress rehearsal, if you want to call it, last night. And so that's the first time that we've been all together.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great. This has to feel so good to see this thing that you started up thriving going forward in so many exciting ways. So are there particular things that you have in mind in terms of the future of Spirit of Racine Music Makers?
Well, number one, I think that we would like to be able to have more opportunities to showcase our group. And that could mean that we might be hired for a graduation ceremony, or we might be hired for an event, and maybe they only want eight people and some instrumentalists. We can arrange for that. So it doesn't have to be the entire group in order to do it. But last Christmas, we did have our group sing for the wonderful called up. I told you that earlier, the group for curling.
Sorry. Oh, right.
So I have to say to Barb, sorry about that. I forgot curling. But no, it was about 150 people at Meadowbrook Country Club. So that was a wonderful experience. And you and I were together with your Caritas group trio at Siena.
Right, for their Welcome Home concert.
Yes, and I have to give you a plug here because you and your group are really phenomenal. It's really wonderful. You do a marvelous job with that, and keep that going as well.
Well, thanks. Hey, yeah, and I thought your group got you were kind of the grand finale of the concert, and fittingly so, and offered up a really lovely musical gift. So it's terrific to see this going forward in such exciting fashion. Remind our listeners about when you rehearse, and if somebody is intrigued by the possibility of maybe being part of this, what they should do.
Okay. We rehearse on Wednesdays, okay, and it's usually from 6:30 to 8 o'clock. So just an hour and a half, no break. It's, you know, it's, you got to be ready with your shoes on, and because we're running right straight through.
Right.
And that's usually for an 11 or 12 week period, depending upon the difficulty of the music that will be chosen for that particular concert. But that's it. So when they're finished like here in spring, aside from this concert this Sunday, we have Music and More that we're going to do on the 22nd. And that is going to be it then until we will come back again in September. So, and we're done in December. So snowbirds can take off wherever they want to go.
Right.
And we'll come back sometime in mid-March to get prepared for our spring concert.
Excellent.
So the best way to find us is on our Facebook page for the Spirit of Racine Music Makers. On there, there's information about us. There's a place for you to do almost like a sign-up and fill out a form telling us something about yourself. And then we certainly will contact the individual who has done it. I've had people that came up after one of the programs and said, I'd like to join this group. What do I have to do? I said, just here's the date. Come then. We'll see where you fit and take it from there. I can tell you one of the things we're really blessed with is that we have 12 male singers. I have 6 tenors and 6 basses. So you can just imagine the male sound that we can get out of that. And but that's the best way. I should also add that if they go to our Facebook page, they can also view on YouTube all of our previous concerts.
Yes, they are all right there and available right from the first one. And
yes.
the various Christmas concerts and spring concerts you've given, including that lovely concert called In the Spirit of Peace that I thought was especially well done. And again, your next concert is coming up this Sunday afternoon, June 4th, 2 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, with a free will offering being taken. Correct, and that will be given to the Red Cross for their disaster relief. George Baumgard at the helm of the group Spirit of Racine Music Makers. Wonderful to talk with you, and we hope a lot of people will turn out for what promises to be a lovely concert this Sunday afternoon. And thanks for being here in the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for mostly sunny skies today and very, very calm winds. We're headed for a high temperature in the mid-80s. Overnight low of 65, and tomorrow should be yet another sunny day with high temperatures in the 80s. News is next. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.